The answer to the question, who was the first African-American Major League Baseball player, is easy. Jackie Robinson. He started playing second base for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. He's so famous and so appreciated, his number, 42, has been retired all across pro baseball. But who else helped integrate professional baseball? Because it was uniformly white across the major and minor leagues. We'll focus on a player who distinguished himself mostly in the minors. Shortstop and second baseman Artie Wilson is the focus of a new book, Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier. It's the work of Galen White, who worked as a sports writer for several newspapers before spending time in the corporate world. He returned to sports writing with two previous books on baseball. Galen White, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Jeff.
Let's talk about your story first. 40 years away from sports writing, that's a big break.
Well, I was and I wasn't. During this period of time, there were some things that I had left undone in terms of things I wanted to write about, and Artie Wilson was one of them. I interviewed Artie in 1975. I had just entered the corporate world around that time. I continued to talk with Artie over the years. In fact, I was in Portland in 75. He lived in Portland at that time, and then also in 1994 and 95. So over a period of 30 years, I met Artie in person there in Portland and also talked with him frequently on the telephone.
Was it pretty clear from the first time you met him that he was worthy of a book of his own?
Well, no.
Ah.
He was going to be part of a book called Left on Base in the Bushes, which was going to be about different minor league greats who either didn't make it to the majors or who had a cup of coffee. Because I spent so much time with Artie, I had material for a book. And when the publisher, Roman and Littlefield, contacted me about a year ago and said they were starting a series on pioneers in sports, I asked them their definition of a pioneer. And they said, well, someone who was not just a great athlete, but also impacted sport and society beyond the game itself. Bingo, Artie Wilson.
So was it close at all? Was he almost the first black major leaguer?
He was recommended by several Negro League owners to Branch Rickey as the black to break the color barrier. Artie was the best shortstop in the Negro Leagues at that time. He was an all-star from 1944 through 1948. Both he and Jackie Robinson were selected to the all-star team in 1945. Jackie, of course, played for the Kansas City Monarchs. Artie played for the Birmingham Black Barons. Artie's batting average during the time he was in the Negro Leagues was .376. That's the third highest in Negro League history. So he clearly had the ability. It came down to Branch Rickey deciding that Jackie Robinson probably was better prepared for what had to be done. Jackie had gone to UCLA, played sports there, had also been in the military. Artie grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and had a little bit of an exposure to white people. He played, of course, against whites on some barnstorming tours, but not nearly the kind of exposure that Jackie Robinson had.
You know, the book begins with World War II and the fact that so many able-bodied men were overseas fighting. I mean, how thin did the pro baseball talent pool get?
Very thin. In fact, if a lot of the players who came back after the war resented the fact that some of these guys came in during the war. Joe Nuxall, who went on to become a very fine pitcher, he at age 15 was brought into the majors. Pete One Arm Gray got his shot in the majors during the war. There were older ball players who by this time were playing on the shuffle board courts. They were brought off and brought out of retirement and played. Cut off the top part of Artie's thumb was cut off in a machine shop accident in 1939. He was still 18 years of age. That was his right throwing hand. For that reason, he got a physical exemption from the military. So he continued to play in the Birmingham Industrial League. And then in 1944, of course, the war is still going on. He then joined the Negro Leagues.
So, but the fact is, he would have gone to war if he had an intact thumb.
That's true. At the same time, of course, the thumb. Some people would consider it a liability. To Artie, it was not. It was on his throwing hand. He just adjusted the way he threw the ball. He adapted slightly how he held the bat. In the Birmingham Industrial League, where he played for 7 years, he batted over 400 five times. His career batting average in that league is the highest in history. So he was a great hitter wherever he played. And that's the reason that the Negro League owners were suggesting to Branch Rickey that, hey, here's your guy.
Well, and again, this is happening at a time during the war when there aren't a lot of able-bodied people available. So this again began to engender calls for why don't we bring in some African-American players, and resistance still, I gather, from what you write here in the book.
Yes. Abe Saperstein, who was part owner of the Birmingham Black Barons and also the owner and founder of the Harlem Globetrotters. Abe Saperstein was a big Artie Wilson fan, as well as Artie's partner at second base, Piper Davis, and he recommended to the Chicago Cubs in 1944 to Phil Wrigley personally. He suggested that they sign Artie and Piper and bring them in as a double play combination for the Cubs in 1944. There was clearly no one better at those positions at that time. Of course, Phil Wrigley did not do that. The Cubs, in fact, did not integrate until 1953 when they brought in another shortstop, Ernie Banks.
Ah, okay. It sounds like a lot of buck passing, though. A lot of like, well, I would do it, except these people won't let me do it, that sort of thing.
Entirely. The buck passing started, of course, in terms of Artie in 44. And then if you move on up to 1949, he was in the middle of this personal dispute between Bill Veeck, the owner of the Cleveland Indians, and George Weiss, the
okay, hold the thought there, because this is such a good story. I want to make sure we give it the full time
sure.
It has. We've got a break coming up. So we'll come back and talk more with Galen White about his book about Artie Wilson, Singles and Smiles, and Artie Wilson's groundbreaking efforts on the field and off as he helped integrate pro baseball, mostly in the minor leagues. He did get to the majors in 1951. We'll talk about that in a moment. Galen White on the Jefferson Exchange, back with you in just a minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about one of the best baseball players you never heard of, Artie Wilson. Had great batting averages and great fielding skills, and really tore up the Negro Leagues in the 1940s. Finally ended up in the minor leagues as the minor leagues integrated. Spent all of 19 games in the majors with the New York Giants in 1951. Big year for the Giants. We'll get into that. Galen White is our guest. He wrote a book about Artie Wilson called Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about pro baseball and its slow integration. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to emphasize the Portland connection here. Artie settled in Portland, it sounds like, in his 30s and lived there until he was 90 when he died finally in 2010, but definitely an Oregonian for two-thirds of his life.
1955, he played for the Portland Beavers, and he fell in love with the city and remained there the rest of his life, lived there 55 years. After he left baseball, he sold cars for a dealership in Gladstone, Oregon, and he's in the Oregon Sports Hall of Fame. So, yes, although he was born in Alabama, I think Artie thought of himself as an Oregonian.
All right. Well, good for him. But so we were talking about this big stink that ended up going on between the owners and general managers of the New York Yankees and the Cleveland Indians over the services of Artie Wilson in the late 40s. What happened there?
Well, the Cleveland Indians won the World Series in 1948. The Yankees, of course, were used to doing that. Bill Veeck had already signed Larry Doby. He'd brought in Satchel Paige, two great Negro League players. And he was after Artie Wilson and Luke Easter, who was a big first baseman with a lot of power. Bill Veeck flew to Puerto Rico and signed both Artie Wilson and Luke Easter. The Yankees, meanwhile, had discussions personally with Artie, but he had signed nothing. They also had talked with the Black Barons owner, Tom Hayes. They offered Artie a salary of $500 a month. He was making $750 with the Black Barons. So why would he take that? He didn't. Wendell Smith, a sports writer for the Pittsburgh Courier, kind of summed up the battle this way. Major league teams are now fighting each other over ballplayers they once fought to keep out of the big leagues. And so Artie was caught in the middle of this battle between two titanics in the game at that time, Bill Veeck of the Indians and George Weiss of the Yankees. Everyone was almost certain that Artie was going to be playing for the Indians. He went to spring training with the Indians, batted 417 in spring training. The decision still had not been made when the season started, so Artie began the 1949 season in the Pacific Coast League with the San Diego Padres and the Indians Farm Club. Then about 6 weeks into the season, the Commissioner of Baseball, Happy Chandler, ruled that Artie belonged to the Yankees. That caught Veeck off by surprise, caught Artie by surprise, and I think it caught the Yankees by surprise. They already had a great shortstop named Phil Rizzuto. Their only reason for going after Artie was to keep him out of Cleveland, away from Bill Veeck. So what happened was the Yankees wound up peddling Artie to the Oakland Oaks, who needed a shortstop. The Oakland Oaks had a second baseman named Billy Martin. And Billy Martin, knowing that Artie was the only black player in the team and would be by himself on road trips, volunteered to room with him on the road.
Yeah, I noticed that in the book, that Billy Martin really stood up for the black players. And as cantankerous as he was on the field, and you wouldn't want to be an umpire in a game Billy Martin was managing, he was a good guy to have for a roommate, it sounds like.
Well, Artie had to talk Billy out of a couple of fights in restaurants. Billy was ready to start a couple of brawls. In fact, one there in Portland, there was a restaurant that he and Artie and Jackie Jensen and a couple of other players had gone into after a game, and they wouldn't serve him. And so Billy was ready to take on whoever was behind the decision, and Artie talked him into leaving without starting a fuss.
Wow. Let's talk about Artie's talents on the field. Galen White's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Singles and Smiles. And can we assume from the book's title that Artie was not a home run hitter?
He only hit 13 home runs in his entire pro baseball career. He was a tremendous singles hitter. He was a left-handed hitter. He hit most of his hits were to left field, so the defense bunched up on him on the left side. The only other player at that time who the defenses tended to shift on was Ted Williams. And in Ted Williams' case, they shifted to the right side because he was a left-handed pole hitter. They started to shift on Artie. They did some in the Negro Leagues, but in the Coast League, there was a manager with the San Francisco Seals named Lefty Odul. And he started a shift against Artie and sometimes pulled the right fielder entirely out of right field. Artie burned him several times when he did that. Overall, the shift didn't make much difference. Oakland's manager at that time was Charlie Dressen. And Charlie Dressen called Lefty's shift on Artie showboating. What was interesting was that when Artie did make it to the majors in 1951 with the Giants, Charlie Dressen was by that time manager of the Dodgers. He batted against the Dodgers only once. And what did Charlie Dressen do? He stepped out of the dugout, acted like he was a traffic cop, and moved everybody to the left side, made a big deal out of it, which, of course, infuriated Leo DeRozier, the manager of the Giants, and many of the Giants players. Artie didn't really care. He was trying to get a hit. Wound up, he grounded back to the pitcher. But that particular incident sort of defined Artie's big league career, at least in New York. The New York writers had never seen a shift like this, and then when Artie couldn't hit one into right field, which was empty, then, of course, that's a question whether or not he had the ability to stay in the big leagues. But he certainly had the ability. He wanted to play every day, though, and he also wanted to not only play every day, but in Oakland he was making more money than he was making with the Giants. So he went to Leo DeRozier, the manager, and said, send me down and bring Willie Mays up. He knew all about Willie Mays because Willie played his first year of pro ball with the Birmingham Black Barons in 1948. So that's how Artie Wilson wound up going back to the minors, and then Willie Mays came up.
You know, that's the part that really staggers me. It's not just that he would do that, but how different the economics of baseball were back then. He could actually make more money playing in Oakland than he could playing for the New York Giants?
Yes. The Pacific Coast League was more major league than the majors in some respects. Traveling, they were traveling by air on the coast at that time. They stayed in first-class hotels, and, of course, the cities that had Coast League teams, Portland, Seattle, Sacramento, San Francisco, Oakland, San Diego, Los Angeles, and also in Los Angeles area was the Hollywood Stars. Those were mild weather cities, and they were fun places for these guys to play. So a lot of veteran players preferred to play in the Coast League where they could make more money and extend their careers.
Really? So that's interesting. So it was like the cushy league, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, it was called the Brother-in-Law League at one time. that was one of its nicknames. In fact, the fellow who named it that was Clay Hopper, who managed the Portland Beavers when Artie was there in 1955. The Coast League, it was my fascination with the Coast League was there were so many great players in that league. Some of them did have fairly good major league careers, but I was fascinated in the case of Artie. I mean, he wound up playing 9 years in the Coast League and hitting .312. He won the Coast League batting title his first year in the league in 1949. He finished second on two other occasions and third another time. So he had a great career in the Coast League, and I always was curious why he didn't do better in the majors. But what it really came down to was by the time he made it to the majors, he was 30 years old. Age was a big deal at that time. And with black players, were always suspected of being a little bit older than what they really were. And that's because Satchel Paige shaved several years off his age. And the same with Luke Easter, who was a teammate of Artie Wilson initially there in San Diego. So it was people thought, well, okay, Artie's saying he's 30. He's probably 2-3 years older than that. He really wasn't. But that became another thing that held him back. The other thing I like to tell people about Artie was that while he had 4 hits and 22 at-bats in the majors, Willie Mays, who was hitting .477 in the minors when he was brought up in 1951, in Willie's first 21 at-bats, he only had 1 hit. So I like to point out that if Artie had been put on, if Willie Mays had been put on the same short leash that Artie Wilson was, we may not have heard Willie Mays.
Wow, that's a good point to bring up. And Artie pointed out, as you mentioned, he wanted to play every day because as a singles hitter, he felt like that's the way he kept his rhythm. He was not a power guy like Willie Mays. The book is called Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier. It's the work of sports writer, corporate guy, and return to sports writer Galen White, who is joining us from Tennessee. And you can join the conversation on The Exchange as we talk about baseball and color and Artie Wilson. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. When you first talked to Artie Wilson in 1975 and interviewed him, what kind of a sense did you get of the guys? I mean, the smiles part is what I want to focus on here, because it sounds like he really was a very upbeat person.
A very positive man. I remember walking into his home and saying, "This home is your home." He just had this wonderful attitude towards life, very positive, and about his career. He had no regrets about his career. In fact, the one regret he did have had nothing to do with himself. It had to do with Josh Gibson, the great hitter who he called the greatest hitter ever to step to the plate, the fact that Josh Gibson never got to play in the major leagues. He wasn't bitter about Jackie Robinson being the first black in baseball. He thought Branch Rickey made the right choice. He had no bitterness towards anyone or anything. And his way of dealing with the racism of the time was quite different than Jackie. Jackie was quite a fiery ball player. Artie was, of course, very competitive. He certainly was not a compliant guy, but he was going to level things off in the playing field, and he thought he could do nothing to change the racial climate at that time, but he could control his response to the racism. So, for example, in Sacramento, there was a fan who called him the N-word, called him every other, a whole bunch of names that Artie had never heard of. Well, what did Artie do? Artie would just get his singles, and he'd get on first base, and he would smile. Later on, in 1957, Artie ended his career in Sacramento. An eye injury forced him to have to step down about middle of the season. Guess who his biggest booster was and who organized Artie Wilson Appreciation Night? The same fan who called him the N-word and was yelling at pitchers to throw at his head. So that's the way Artie won fans over. He was a great in-between guy between black and white players. In Portland, he was known for his chant, "Never fear, Artie's here." His teammates One of his teammates who wrote the foreword in the book, Ed Mickelson, remembers that most about Artie, on how he would walk onto the field and he'd just lift everybody up with his chatter, his smile, and just the way he viewed life.
Sounds a lot like Ernie Banks in a lot of ways, in the sunny disposition, certainly.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. Of course, Ernie Banks is best known for saying, "Let's play two."
Right.
Artie could have coined the phrase, "Let's play five," and here's what I mean. Artie played two games, a Sunday doubleheader with the Black Barons in Birmingham. Then the next day, which was Labor Day, they played a doubleheader in Memphis, Tennessee. That night, they traveled 200 miles to Jackson, Mississippi, and played a game later that night, meaning that they played five games in 36 hours. Artie loved to play baseball. In fact, his teammate there in Portland, Eddie Basinski, Eddie's still living, by the way, Eddie remembers getting calls from Artie on their off days and saying, "Let's go to the ballpark and play Pepper."
Wow, this is a dedicated guy. Artie Wilson, again, the topic we're talking about here. The book is called Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier. Galen White is the author of the book and our guest on The Exchange. So let's go back to Artie's past, because we haven't talked about that very much. He did grow up in very segregated Birmingham. We established that much. Where did he first play baseball?
In Birmingham, with the phrase, "You wouldn't know your father if he walked into the room," that was the case. He once was in a room with his father, didn't know who he was. That was the only time he saw his father. His mother, unfortunately, died when she was 40. Artie quit high school so that she wouldn't have to work the three jobs she was working. Artie saved money from shining shoes to buy his first ball glove for $2.98. If he didn't have a baseball available, he would make a baseball. If he didn't have a bat available, he'd find a way to make a bat. He played baseball from the time he was a little guy, and playing often against older guys. And that enabled him to move into the Birmingham Industrial League and play immediately and be a success. So he played 7 years in the Birmingham Industrial League. He would have moved over to the Negro Leagues earlier, but there were, at that time, because of the economic conditions, there were a lot of players who had left the Industrial League there in Birmingham and played in the Negro Leagues and came home without any money. So Artie was a frugal man. He was, he wanted to make sure that he didn't remain poor his whole life. He made very good salaries in the Negro Leagues, and he was one of the top paid ball players in the Coast League as well.
Just to be clear about segregation, there was a white team, the Birmingham Barons, in the minor leagues, and then in the Negro Leagues there was the Birmingham Black Barons. This is a storied team in its day, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
This was a very popular, a big team, a storied team in the history of the Negro Leagues.
Yes. They were the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball, in large part because Abe Saperstein was part owner. But Abe Saperstein had these connections all over the world, so the Birmingham Black Barons traveled to Japan. They traveled to Hawaii. They played at Yankee Stadium and other major league ballparks. So they were playing baseball all the time. In fact, several of the Birmingham Black Baron baseball players also played for the Globetrotters, one of them being Piper Davis, who was Artie's sidekick with the Black Barons and in the Birmingham Industrial League.
This sounds like a very hard life. I mean, as much as Artie loved to play and was like the "let's play five in two days" guy, I mean, this is not an easy life. I mean, we're talking non-air-conditioned buses, which often served as their restaurant and hotel as well, given the segregation of the time.
This is true. And, of course, he played during the winter. Artie's feeling was, if you're playing baseball somewhere, I'm going to be part of it. So during the winter, he played seven winters in Puerto Rico, where, by the way, he's in the Puerto Rico Sports Hall of Fame there. He should be in the Negro League Hall of Fame here in the States, and that's one of the things, one of the outcomes I hope from this book, is that he'll finally get the recognition that he deserves. Not just Artie, but there were a number of other black players who integrated the minor leagues who, in writing this book, I wanted to the extent I could, bring attention to these fellows, because they were just as instrumental as Jackie Robinson and some of the others were in the majors, and I wanted their story to be known. In the case of Artie, because I'd spent so much time with him, I saw the opportunity to let people know what kind of a person he was. He was just a great human being. He was a pillar there in Portland in terms of his church. He was one of the dealerships where he worked. He worked there for 55 years. He didn't quit working until age 85.
Wow.
He used to always say, "No sense sitting in a rocking chair." But he would go from his home in Portland, go to the Bomber Inn there in Gladstone, have breakfast, and then he'd go to the dealership. And usually the way he sold cars was talking baseball. People would come from miles around to talk baseball with Artie Wilson.
And now we're talking about Artie Wilson and baseball, and we're going to continue the discussion with Galen White on the other side of a break. The book is called Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier. If you're just joining us, Artie spent most of his time in the minor leagues, but many of those in Portland, and he settled in Oregon and spent 55 years there before he died just a few years ago in 2010 at age 90. More about Artie Wilson with Galen White and with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking to Galen White, who worked as a sports writer for several major newspapers before departing for the corporate world for several decades. He came back, never left sports writing completely, had ideas for books, and he has brought out a third now called Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier. Artie Wilson, a very slick fielding shortstop and singles hitter in the Negro Leagues and minor leagues, including in Portland. He got 22 at-bats in the major leagues with the New York Giants in 1951, and that was it. We're talking about his life story and how it figures in the whole story of the integration of baseball with Galen White. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I was just setting myself a little task here, flipping through the photographs in the book, looking for one in which Artie Wilson isn't smiling. I haven't really found one yet, but I really like this one of a reunion of the 1948 Birmingham Black Barons in Beverly Hills in 2007. So there's Willie Mays and Artie Wilson and Greason and some of the other great players from that team.
Yes, that was the last time Artie and Willie Mays were together, and that was at an event in Beverly Hills, California. There were five Black Barons at that time. There's only two living now, Willie Mays and Reverend Bill Greason, who's also in that photograph. Artie's last public appearance was in 2007. He threw out a first pitch at a game at Safeco Field in Seattle and got a standing ovation because it wasn't your usual ceremonial first pitch. Artie went through, put on a show for the fans, as he did when he was a ball player. In fact, Piper Davis, who I've mentioned earlier in the interview and was played with Artie with the Birmingham Black Barons, he had a great explanation for the Negroes breaking into white baseball. He said the Negro ball player gave big league baseball the unexpected, the daring, because we loved the game and we've played more for the fans than ourselves. Piper also said this of Artie and Willie Mays. Willie Mays, he played for the fans. Artie played for the fans. And some of those fans were celebrities like the actor George Raft. When Artie played in Hollywood, George Raft would yell at Artie, "They're bunching up on you, they're bunching up on you," because the defense would move to the left side. And Artie would yell back, "Don't worry, I'll drop one in there." Joe Louis was another big Artie Wilson fan. Lionel Hampton was a big Artie Wilson fan. In fact, Lionel Hampton performed at Artie's 40th wedding anniversary celebration there in Portland. So he was the kind of guy that electrified fans. They loved to see him play, and he just was a fun guy to watch. You didn't forget seeing Artie Wilson play. And also, one other thing I wanted to make sure I mention is that he had a comeback. Now, it was not your usual comeback. He retired officially in 1957. In 1962, he was selling cars there in Gladstone, Oregon. He frequently would go to Multnomah Stadium to pitch batting practice. The Beavers, the Portland Beavers, were still there in Portland. And so he went out, as he often did, to throw batting practice. And while he was there, the manager, Les Peaton, says, we need you. The Beavers had several injuries, and they needed somebody to play infield. So Artie wound up playing 19 games for the Portland Beavers at second base, did not commit a single error. He'd been away from the game for 5 years. When he finished his month-long stint with the Beavers, he got another call. This one from Kennesaw, Washington, from one of his former managers who was managing the Tri-City Braves. And he says, we've got several injuries here, and we got 2 weeks to go in the season. We need some help. Artie went down there and played two more weeks.
I noticed that stat, and I was curious about that. I noticed he played in the Northwest League, and I thought, well, that's kind of a low minor league for Artie, particularly that late in his life. So there's the story. He was playing for Tri-City. That's funny.
Right. He was helping out because the team had so many injuries. And that's just, you know, Artie, later on when I was around Artie, in fact, I was with him in 1994 during the record-setting player strike.
Sure.
And he was almost in tears when he discussed the strike, but Artie had his glove, and he was ready to play.
Wow, he wanted to be a replacement. That's funny. I wonder if on that that 2007 throwing out the first ball at Safeco Field, if he had a chance to visit with Ichiro at all, because their styles in spraying singles and running out of the box fast have been compared.
I don't know the answer to that, but you do make a very good point. At bat, if to try to visualize what he was like, was a lot like Ichiro in that he was running when he hit the ball. On defense, he was a lot like Ozzie Smith, known as the Wizard of Oz for his great shortstop playing. In the Negro Leagues, Artie was nicknamed the Octopus because sometimes it seemed like he had eight arms at shortstop. He was called the Groundsweeper in Puerto Rico. He just had this effect on people. When I called Orlando Cepeda to talk about Artie, Orlando did not play with Artie, but he saw him as a kid in Puerto Rico. And the first thing he said was, I love Artie Wilson. He inspired me to be a ball player. And this is from a man whose father, Pedro, was a professional baseball player.
Oh, that's right, the bull and the baby bull, yeah.
That's right.
So you know, we mentioned Satchel Paige briefly here, and you mentioned in the book that the first time Artie faced Satchel Paige pitching against him, he doubled off of him. And there's a story here about how Satchel Paige handled that.
Satchel Paige went to second base where Artie was and said, heard a lot about you, young buck. Why don't you just sit down? You're not going anywhere. He struck out the next three batters.
Now, he and Satchel Paige, Artie and Satchel Paige did play on the same team at some point, though. Is that right?
Yes. Artie was the shortstop on the Satchel Paige All-Stars that traveled from the East Coast to the West Coast with the Bob Feller All-Stars. That was the storied barnstorming tour that really was based upon taking advantage of sort of the racial rivalries at that time. And that tour was very instrumental in that it proved that white fans were very interested in seeing white players play against black players. And I think that helped kind of set the stage for what Jackie Robinson would do in 1947. The tour of Jackie Robinson and, the tour of Satchel Paige and Bob Feller was in 1946.
Okay, so the next year before Jackie Robinson broke in with the Dodgers. Once Jackie Robinson did get on with the Dodgers and other teams began to hire African-American players, what then happened to the Negro Leagues?
Well, when Jackie went into joined the Dodgers in 1947, the Negro Leagues were in trouble already because all the attention of Negro fans was on what Jackie was doing and some of the other players who were being brought in at that time. Roy Campanella was brought into the minor leagues by the Dodgers. The Indians had Larry Doby. So the Pittsburgh Courier, which was a black weekly newspaper, they would have this listing of all the black players who were in organized baseball, and, of course, the fans followed these. And the coverage of the Negro Leagues just sort of dried up because there just wasn't as much interest in it. 1948 would probably be the watershed moment for the Negro Leagues. You still had a fairly good following, and that was the year, by the way, that Artie Wilson hit .402,
mm-hmm.
Making him the last 400 hitter in baseball at the major league level in both black and white. And, of course, that was the year that Willie Mays broke in the pro ball, was was with the Birmingham Black Barons in 48. And one other thing I might mention here is that, you know, Artie tried to get Willie to play in the Coast League. What happened was Willie's father, Cat Mays, was a good friend of Artie's, had played against him in the Birmingham Industrial League. And Cat Mays had gone to Artie and said that he wanted him to become Willie's legal guardian and take him to Oakland because as his legal guardian, then Artie could play pro ball. He was still in high school, so without a legal guardian being on the team, he could not. Artie took that proposition to the Oakland Oaks management, and they never acted on it.
Hmm. So we have a call here. Bill in Wairika wants to join the conversation. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Galen White.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. My grandfather's name was Hugh Albertson, and he was born in 1887 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he was very much of the religion of baseball. He claims that he was good enough to be a professional ball player in the early 20th century, but it was not his mother felt it wasn't a classy enough position. But when I was a kid, he would make me go get the sporting news for him all the time, and he told me, once there was an article about the colored leagues, he said that the Homestead Grays and the Pittsburgh Crawfords, that was the best game around. And he often had opportunity to play with them, and he would paint himself with iodine so that he could play on the colored leagues. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, but he told me that, and he was a bigot. I mean, this was a guy of the time. I've never heard him call a black person anything other than the N-word. But when it came to baseball, that was where it really worked for him.
Wow. Okay, that's an amazing story. Thanks for joining us with that, Bill. I appreciate that. So the quality of play, I mean, you were talking, you've described Galen, as the Negro Leagues being as good as the Major Leagues. They really were.
Yes. In 1951, Sport Magazine came out with a Negro League All-Star team. Artie Wilson was on that team. He had yet to play a game in the majors, but he was on that team as the shortstop. The other players on that team were Jackie Robinson, Roy Campanella, Larry Doby. One other player who I'm forgetting, there was four future Hall of Famers already on that All-Star team by 1951. If the black players had been allowed to play earlier, I think they would have populated the game. The percentages would have been as high then as they are now. Just by the fact that, you know, Jackie Robinson was Rookie of the Year, then Roy Campanella became a most valuable player. Sam Jethro, who played for the Boston Braves, was Rookie of the Year in 1950. So the black players, once they entered the game, they started to dominate the game.
So a number of what-ifs here begin to emerge, and among them a what-if for Artie. If that maneuver between the Yankees and Indians had turned out differently and he had ended up playing or in the Cleveland organization, is there a chance he might have made it to the majors sooner and might have gotten a better chance?
Absolutely. The shortstop for the Indians at that time was Lou Boudreau. Now, he was coming off of an MVP year in 1948, but Lou was older, and he also had some injury issues. And, of course, he went downhill real quickly. Artie would have inherited the shortstop position from Lou Boudreau. Also, if Artie had made it to the majors at that time, 1949, he's 2 years younger than when he got his shot in 1951. Wherever Artie would have had a chance to play every day in the majors, my own personal opinion is he would have done what he did in the Coast League. And that, of course, is a hit well over 300. 1 year he led the Coast League in stolen bases. He had great speed. I was talking with one pitcher who said that if Artie got on first base, he went ahead and threw to third just to head him off. he was extremely fast. Another thing that's often lost about Artie was he had great bat control. Earlier this year, there was a lot made of Brandon Belt of the San Francisco Giants having a 21-pitch at bat. That was normal for Artie. In a typical game, he would foul off between 20 and 25 pitches. I was talking with Willie Mays, and he recalled the one time with Birmingham where Artie fouled off 15 pitches in a single at bat. That was one of the things he did to wear a pitcher down and also to get the kind of pitch that he wanted to try to hit the left field.
Wow. Is there any film of Artie playing? Is there any motion picture footage?
I don't – not that I came across. Of course, he was in the Coast League playing regularly up until 1957. He made that cameo appearance with the Beavers in 1962. I'm sure there would be some footage of Artie throwing out the first pitch at Safeco Field. Mm-hmm. But, no, I have not seen any. But I did see him play. I grew up in Los Angeles. I was born in 1946, so my father started to take me to Los Angeles Angels games. They played at Wrigley Field there in L.A., and Artie would come to town. And you just once you saw him, you didn't forget him. He was 5 foot 10, 162 pounds. He was kind of bow-legged. Kind of a spidery effect is what I remember, and you just remembered him. Of the modern-day players, too, more recently, you know, Harold Reynolds is from Oregon. I think he grew up in Corvallis. And so he was very much like Harold in terms of his physique and how he played the game and how he smiled.
Oh, well, you know, the book itself does bring a smile to your face in learning more about Artie Wilson. The book is called Singles and Smiles, How Artie Wilson Broke Baseball's Color Barrier. It's the work of Galen White. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.